It's Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden age. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark LeVernier. Some stirring drama coming up in this hour. Later on, we hear Columbia Presents Corwin from 1944, but right now it's Willis Cooper's Quiet Please. Ernest Chappell stars in the Cooper story, Let the Lilies Consider. This first heard on the Mutual Broadcasting System on June 28, 1948.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. Broadcasting System presents Quiet Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet Please for tonight is called Let the Lilies Consider.
Yes, I quite understand. I quite understand. Well, your stenographer is taking down everything I say. You and you are witnesses. When the stenographer transcribes his notes, I'm to sign them. And that is my confession, is that right? And whatever I say may be used against me, is that right? Oh, I'll sign them all right. Where do you want me to start? At the beginning, I suppose. All right. For your record, my name is James R. James. Roderick. 41, third-generation American college graduate. UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. No occupation. No, not unemployed. No occupation. Well, I have a small but adequate income. You have my address. I was married in... Gretchen. Gretchen McMonies. Yes, Gretchen is a diminutive of Margaret. Margaret McMonies. An orphan.
Where's your wife now, James?
Please don't try to trap me, Lieutenant. I've told you at least 20 times where she is.
Tell me again.
Right there. There.
Look, James, we dug that place up twice now. Your wife isn't there. Where is she?
I've told you.
What did you do with her?
I didn't do anything with her, Lieutenant. I've told you that.
All right. Go on.
I met her at school in 1930.
Did you bury her in the flower bed there?
May I go on?
Answer my question. Did you bury her?
No, I did not.
Then why do you keep saying she's there?
Because
you killed her.
No.
Well, she's dead. What killed her?
I've told you she isn't dead.
You can't prove it, James.
I can prove it, Lieutenant, but you won't believe it.
Why don't you prove it, then?
Shall I go on with my statement?
Did you plant that lily there to mark her grave, James?
I didn't plant that lily.
How come it grows there? How come it's so much bigger than the others? Answer me.
There were other lilies there alongside it. Before you and your men dug them up?
James, I think I know why that lily is bigger than the others.
You do?
Yes, and so do you.
You're wrong, Lieutenant.
You know why we left that lily standing, James, when we dug up the others?
Yes.
Because we know what's under it there. Because we figured the lily would remind you, would keep you thinking about your wife buried there. Because we hoped it might lead you to a confession.
It won't, Lieutenant.
You know... I have an idea that lily there is going to hang you, James.
No, it isn't. That lily loves me. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these.
What are you talking about?
We consider the lilies, and some of us love them. Do you suppose the lilies consider us and sometimes return our love?
I don't think you'll get by with an insanity plea, James.
I don't know very much about flowers. I don't know anything about them from the standpoint of books. I'm not interested in stamens and pistils and the anatomy of flowers. Well, I'm interested in their souls. In their souls. I believe flowers love and hate just as people do.
Shall we get along with your statement?
Yes. They love us and hate us in the proportions of the love or the hate we have for them. I said I've always loved flowers. My wife, Gretchen, she hated them. And they love me. Gretchen?
You know, James, I declare I think flowers don't like me at all. I can't do a thing with them.
You'll learn. I'll show you how to handle them.
I don't think I want to handle them. James, must we have so many flowers?
Why? I like them, dear.
But so many of them.
Well, I haven't anything else to do but raise flowers.
I know. That's what bothers me. I don't like to see you wasting all your time puttering around flower beds every single hour. Goodness, I think it's just kind of wicked, James, when there's so many other things you could be doing.
Aren't you happy?
Of course I'm happy, but I could be happier if I didn't have to compete with a lot of silly flowers.
Well, I don't think they're silly.
Besides, there's so many lilies.
Well, they're so beautiful.
They're so depressing.
I love them.
That's what bothers me, James.
Why?
Well, I'm jealous of them, James.
Gretchen.
James, you do love me more than you love the flowers, don't you?
Isn't that a pretty foolish question?
James?
What?
Look. Look at the lilies.
Why, what do you...
Look at them. They're listening. They're waiting to hear what you say.
And I looked. And I tell you, there was a silence in the garden there that you could almost hear. And the lilies around us were leaning forward, leaning toward us as we stood there. And there was an attitude of expectancy about them, as their graceful stems bent toward us, trembling. They were listening. And suddenly Gretchen broke from my arms and ran sobbing into the house, trampling their beautiful, delicate bodies underfoot as she ran. No, I didn't follow her. And I stood for a long time in the twilight, considering these lilies of the field. And they watched me, considering me in silence as I lifted up the murdered flowers from the marks of Gretchen's shoes in the soil and wept a moment for them. And I never did answer Gretchen's question. I could have answered it, but she never asked me again. Perhaps she thought she knew the answer.
So that's why you killed her. Because you thought more of the flowers than you did of her.
I didn't kill her.
Go on.
I did love Gretchen. I love her now more than I ever did.
It sounds as if you did.
We were very happy for a long time that winter. There are no flowers in the winter, and she had no cause to feel neglected. It was very pleasant here in the house. But the spring came, and the buds appeared on the trees. And one day, she brought up the subject again.
James, what about the flowers this year?
I'm going to start in the gardens tomorrow.
I wish...
Wish what, darling?
Do we have to have the flowers again?
We don't have to have them, but I want them.
It's been so nice all winter without them.
I've missed them.
I'd hoped you'd maybe forgotten them, James.
Forgotten them? Why, darling, I don't believe I could live without them.
If they all died, what would you do?
I don't know.
Would you die?
What are you talking about, Gretchen?
I'm being very foolish and very silly, James, but I don't want the flowers. I hate flowers.
Now, dear.
I hate them.
You mustn't say that, Gretchen. They'll hate you.
That's just what's the matter. You've let those flowers become an obsession with you. You've begun to feel that they're alive, that they have feelings. You're letting these things take you away from me, and I won't have it.
Gretchen, you're being...
I said I was being silly. I know I am. But it's the truth just the same. Oh, we could do so many things this summer. Go to so many places.
But
and...
I don't want to go places, Gretchen.
You did before you went so crazy over flowers. Over those horrible lilies.
Darling, they're so beautiful.
You used to say I was beautiful.
Well, you are.
But not as beautiful as the lilies. Am I?
Why, dear, you're like a lily yourself. Your skin is so white. Your yellow hair. And that green dress.
Don't you compare me with one of those things. Do you hear me? I'm not like a flower. I'll never be like a flower.
Dear, please, don't.
James, do you know what I think? Sometimes I think there's something wrong with your mind. Sometimes I think you're a little crazy. Do you realize that I'm your wife, do you? Or do you think you're married to those flowers? I won't have it. You've got to choose between those dreadful flowers and me.
I wondered if my mind was all right. There's nothing wrong with loving flowers, is there? Almost everyone loves them. But for my wife to be jealous of them, I wondered for a moment whether it was my mind or hers. Yes, I did spend too much time in the gardens, I thought. And I resolved manfully to change my way, to devote only a few hours a day to cultivation and admiration of my precious lilies. I would compromise. I would try to follow my wife's wishes, try to remember her first instead of the flowers. I reckoned without the flowers. I planted only half as many this year. And Gretchen watched sullenly from the house. They came up eagerly, and I could have sworn that there were twice as many as I planted. Gretchen wouldn't speak to me for days at a time. In mornings when I awoke, I would sometimes find her staring out the window at the lushness of the garden. And in her eyes, I saw a look of awful hatred. It was her attitude, I suppose, that led me to spend more and more time in the garden. And the flowers rewarded me. They were more beautiful, more gracious, more abundant than I've ever seen them. And they returned the loving care I gave them. They poured out their love for me in waves of scent. And their leaves caressed my hands as I bent over them. And as I labored among them, they bent their perfect heads to brush against my cheek. And for long hours, I could forget Gretchen, my wife. Until a rustle among the lilies caused me to look up and see my wife standing in a window in the house, gazing out hatefully at us. And the lilies and I looked back at her with something of fear in our hearts. And the garden grew and flourished beyond my fondest hopes. Slowly, I came to the realization that my garden of lilies was increasing in size, that there were hundreds more than I'd set out in a spring. And I smiled on them happily. And the lilies smiled back at me. The lilies loved me. But there was a summer night and a full moon. And I sat on the porch alone and dreamed of... What did I dream of? There was a voice. A murmurous voice above the little breeze in the garden. And the voice was without words. And yet it was the voice of a loved one. Of a lover. And it spoke to me sadly, caressingly, in sounds that did not need the form of words. And I sat there, alone in the darkness, and listened. And at last the words came.
James!
I love you. Oh! Why, Gretchen!
James, I can't stand it any longer.
Why, what's the matter, Gretchen?
I told you a long time ago that you've got to choose between me and those flowers.
Now, dear,
I'm not going to live in this house like a prisoner any longer. Those flowers are driving me mad. I never see you from morning till night. You've forgotten all about me. I don't mean a thing to you.
Well, that's not true, Gretchen. I do love you.
But you love those flowers more.
Gretchen, I...
I love you. And what are you going to do about it?
What shall I do?
Do you want the flowers or do you want me?
I...
Choose, James.
Love you.
Gretchen.
Love you.
I can't.
And Gretchen turned away without another word and went into the house. I could not move. The chanting in my ears had become a hypnotic lullaby now.
and my eyes closed, and I think I slept. And then suddenly I was awakened by Gretchen's shrill laughter somewhere and the flaring of a brilliant light. And the garden was a sheet of flame. Among the lilies, Gretchen dashed with a great torch she'd fashioned of a broom soaked with kerosene. And the noble tall lilies withered in its blast as she thrust it in their faces. And above the crackling of the flames, above her hysterical laughter, I could hear the keening of strange, lost voices. And I could make out words above the sound of the catastrophe that my wife had begun. And they were sad beyond belief. And I roused myself and ran to the garden, but I was too late. Like some avenging demon, my wife stood triumphant amidst the scorched and blistered dying flowers. And she laughed again. And now she thought she'd won. And there were no more flowers to be jealous of. And when the sun rose in the morning, I went sadly out of the house to contemplate the miserable remains of my loved ones. It was as if nothing had happened on that dreadful night. The lilies that I had last seen smoldering in the moonlight had raised their smiling heads again, and there was no sign of fire about them. And listen to this, you who refuse to believe that flowers, too, live and reason and love. There were thousands more lilies now than there'd been the night before. They had burst the bounds of the garden and they extended halfway across the graveled walk that bordered the garden. And from the house came the despairing sobbing of the woman who had tried desperately to destroy the flowers that loved me. I had feared for my wife's sanity. Now I feared for my own. It was hours before she could do more than weep. At last, she spoke to me.
James, I'm going to leave here.
No, Gretchen.
I've got to. I didn't believe, but...
I won't let you go.
You don't love me. Why should I stay? Save one. They'll never forgive me. They'll kill me.
No.
James, I want you to listen to me. I love you. I'll always love you.
I love you, Gretchen.
But you love the flowers more than you do me.
No, I don't.
You don't mean that.
I mean it.
But it's no use. They love you, James. They're going to have you. I tried to destroy them, and they can't be destroyed. If I don't get away from here...
I can't let you go, Gretchen.
I love you, James.
Stay.
What if I do stay? I'll die. They'll have you.
No.
They hate me.
Gretchen.
They love you. What can I do?
Well, I don't know, but...
You can't fight them. You won't fight them.
I know. I can't fight them. They love me.
And I love you, James. It's too late now to choose.
I won't let them have you. I love you.
Look at the window.
I looked at the window. Outside stood another lily. There had been none there before this morning. There it stood. And as I raised my head, I could see more and more of them all the way across the lawn, overflowing the garden walls. Thousands of them, each with its flower cup, turned toward the house, each one listening. And I turned back to Gretchen, miserable and afraid. She'd risen from the bed and was standing before her dresser. Gretchen, I called, for I knew what was in the second drawer of the dresser.
There's no other way, Jane.
Put it down, Gretchen. We'll think of a way.
There's no other way. I don't know how this has happened, but I believe now. I believe they love you, James, and they hate me.
Gretchen, no. Put it down.
No, James. This is the way out. It's the only way out. I won't let them have you. I won't give you up.
Then she raised the pistol until it pointed straight at my heart. And I said once more, no, Gretchen.
It has to be this way, James. And then I'll go out and give myself up to them. Darling, I love you.
I must have lain there for a long, long time. At last, my eyes opened, and it was dusk again, and I struggled to rise. My side pained horribly, and it was a long time before I could reconstruct what had happened. And I lay there thinking and wondering, what had happened to Gretchen? Was I to die here alone? Was she dead too?
Love you. Love.
And then I heard the voice again.
Love you. Love
Gretchen.
You will not die. Gretchen has not died. We love you. We want you to be happy. You love Gretchen. Gretchen lives. Gretchen loves you.
And I drifted away again into the gathering darkness with a voice.
Love you.
Still ringing.
Love you. Love you.
It's a fine story, James.
Yes.
You didn't tell us before that you'd been shot.
Here's the scar.
Yeah. What became of your wife?
That's a remarkably beautiful lily there, the big one. The one you couldn't remove when you were digging.
Well?
Gretchen was gold and white like a lily. Gretchen's green dress was the color of leaves.
What are you trying to tell me, James?
Do you see something on the stem of that lily, Lieutenant?
Where?
Just below the flower.
Let me see. It's a ring.
Our wedding ring.
How'd it get there?
Gretchen.
What?
I told you she was here with us. Darling.
Love you. Love you. Love you.
No, I didn't get it signed, Chief. There wasn't anybody there to sign it. I'm telling you. I heard the voice myself. It kept saying, love you, love you, love you. That's right. We looked around to see where it was coming from, and when we turned around again, James was gone. I don't know. All I know is there were two lilies there now, close together. Great big ones. And they looked as if they had their arms around each other.
Quiet Please for tonight was called Let the Lilies Consider. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper. James, the man who spoke to you, was Ernest Chappell.
And Kathleen Cordell played Gretchen. The voice of the lilies was Peggy Stanley, and James Bowles was the police lieutenant. As usual, music for Quiet Please is played by Albert Berman. Now, for a word about next week, here is our writer-director, Willis Cooper.
Of course, you will never meet any of the characters in tonight's story. They didn't exist before I thought them up, and they're not imitations of anybody. Next week, Quiet Please story will be called Tahini Tahiti.
And so, until next week at this time, I am quietly yours, Ernest Chappell.
Quiet Please comes to you from New York
and was transcribed earlier from Eastern Mutual for this presentation.
Quiet Please on Tuned to Yesterday, that Mutual broadcast first heard on June 28, 1948. It's an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levionier. Now we go back to the Second World War for a powerful story from Norman Corwin on Columbia Presents Corwin on CBS. The head of CBS Radio, William S. Paley, had long thought that there was too much sponsor control on radio, where more Hollywood names were brought to the forefront than great writing and great stories. And to this end, he had no problem giving radio's poet laureate Norman Corwin several of his own series to showcase his work, whether it be performed in verse or like this next story, which profiles a dead soldier's life called Untitled. This first heard on May 30th, 1944.
Untitled, a new work written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for CBS, and starring the distinguished actor of stage, screen, and radio, Frederick March, in the principal role. The music is by Bernard Herrmann. Frederick March in Norman Corwin's Untitled.
With reference to Hank Peters, he is dead. That much is certain. The fact of his death is common knowledge to himself and to the files of the War Department in Washington, D.C., and has been taken into consideration by his relatives and friends. Perhaps you knew Hank Peters, or perhaps if you didn't know him, you saw him somewhere and didn't know it was he. Quite possible. Because at one time or other, he rode on the coaches of the Santa Fe, the Union Pacific, New York Central. He mingled with crowds in depots across the land. And at various times, was among the audiences at widespread Orpheum and Lowell theaters. He strolled on leave down Broadway, Wilshire Boulevard, Wabash Avenue, and the main streets of Killeen, Texas. He frequently ate blue plates at scattered Child's restaurants, was known to have purchased sodas, razor blades, and magazines at Liggett drugstores. And before he was apprenticed to the war, he drove many a mile over many a state highway. So it's quite possible that at some time or other you may have passed him, seen him, talked to him, or jostled in the same crowd with him. Well, anyway, he's dead now. A couple of the boys sorted out his belongings and put them in a canvas bag and sent them home. There wasn't much to send.
Wristwatch?
Check.
Shaving kit?
Check.
Wallet?
Check.
$14 American.
$14?
62 lira.
What'll his family do with lira?
Never mind. Put it down there. Portable radio?
Check.
Deck of cards?
Check.
Pack of letters?
Check.
4 snapshots.
Let me see.
Come on, come on. Marksman's medal.
Right.
That's all.
These things were sent home in a neat package. But what could not be sent home were items unassorted and unrelated, which died within his head when he was hit. Telephone numbers. The taste of good hot grub on a cold, rainy day. The image of the evening plane caught in a skein of searchlights over the town, pulling the whole web with it across the sky. The paralyzed newsboy on Maple and Elm, who could barely hold coins in his hand while he counted change. The shimmer and float of summer, and the bright, bare legs of a woman. The posture of his dog, faking exhaustion. Lying with his head down on the floor, but watching his every move. Oh, a great many corny things and a few others, including the antique smell of books in the public library and the moon going down over the shoulder of his girl, Marion, as they sat on the porch into the hours of the forming of dew. These items, of course, cannot be reconstructed as he felt them, and neither can Hank Peters be reconstructed. At least in the form by which you may possibly have known him. As for his life, there is no straightforward account available, but there are several people who could piece it together, although they cannot always be relied on to give you a true interpretation of the facts. Let us start, then, with two men who saw him last and first. Neither friends nor relatives, but professional men, and thus unprejudiced, this way or that. I'm a medical officer attached to the 6th Company, 22nd Regiment, 10th Division. In this coffin, we have reason to believe, is the body of Hank Peters, Private First Class. I shall read you the contents of his death certificate. Henry Charles Peters, 26, identification number 840-6912, killed in action of the following injuries. Abdominal lacerations, lower left quadrant, fracture of the sternum, ruptured spleen, internal hemorrhages, severed right arm. That is all.
Ah, but you've left out the important things. He died also of a broken Hebrew and multiple abrasions of the skin of a Chinese. And where in the report have you mentioned what happened in a little Spanish town in 1938?
I am the doctor who 26 years ago delivered Henry Charles Peters. My file says primipara. Normal labor of about 6 hours, no complications, anesthesia, ether, weight 6 pounds, 4 ounces. It was a simple birth.
Ah, but it was not a simple birth. His mother's womb having inward connections with Scandinavia and the springs and winters of that region. The seed of his father being out of the cross-fertilizations of restless migratory peoples and the silt and backwash of 1,000 continental waters. And at his birth, his pulse was 130, and his states were 48. His respiration normal, and his rights equal. And there were 56 teeth implicit in his gums, and 21 amendments in his constitution. And although he was blind at birth and without a mind of his own, he was nevertheless automatically a citizen of his country, certain privileges having been obtained in his name and underwritten by many men, among them some too famous to be mentioned, and others less famous, who died in battles too familiar to be here recounted. Do you call that a simple birth?
I am his mother. His hair was light when he was born, but it turned dark later. When he was still in knee pants, he got into a fight with some other boys at the corner of our street and got cut with a piece of metal. That's how he got the scar on his chin. He was a dreamer, Henry was, with all kinds of ideas. It seems like he was never one for the girls, hardly, until he met Marion. I remember how I was hoping he wouldn't be drafted, but he went and enlisted. And when he went away to the war, he said he knew exactly why he was going and said he'd be back when the war was over and not to worry. But I worried. Why did he have to get killed? Why did it have to happen to my boy? He kissed me goodbye on a Thursday morning, and the last I saw of him was when he went out the front door, and I hurried into the front room and watched him through the front window, going down the street.
Down the street a piece, there was fighting, Mother. And your boy got hit with a piece of metal. Who will come to the door and tell her why? It was a long street he started down, Mother. All the way on Maple and continuing on Piccadilly and the Nevsky Prospect. Winding down around the main drag of Canberra and connecting with footpaths in the Solomons. And many mothers and many windows on that street, Mother. And many a turning and a sudden intersection. Where it leads to is, of course, the question of our time.
I was his teacher. He was a fair student, nothing out of the ordinary. His average grade was B minus overall, rating a C in English, an A in history, D in geography, and B in chemistry. Best mark was in history. He was in the lower third of his graduating class. Now, that is all that we have in the record.
There is more to the record. Sir, he went beyond you in geography, learning that an ocean is a strait, a continent an isthmus, learning that the sky is the limit of the letting of blood, and learning the lay of the darkest land. Sir, he has been graduated with honors, and he shall have a good mark in history forever.
It was I who gave him music lessons. He started with the violin at the age of 12 and went as far as the third position. I'm sorry to say he wasn't a very good pupil. I understand his mother had a hard time making him practice. When he was about 15, he got a sudden passion to be a drummer, and so he gave up the violin. I advised against him doing it, but he was all caught up with traps and snares and paraphernalia, and I suppose he had to have his fling. There's no accounting for the taste of adolescence. When he was 19 or so, he got to appreciate good music. And in fact, the last time I talked with him was at a concert at the Memorial Building in town. He was there with his girl, and we met at intermission and made a date to meet afterward. And Mr. Draper and I and Henry and Marion went to an ice cream parlor, and we had a fine time talking about things in general. And I got to like him very much. I saw him a couple of times after that at the movies, but I never again got to speak to him. I was really sorry to hear about him. I mean, about what happened to him.
Who was it fiddled while Rome was burning the native huts of Abyssinia? A very respectable gentleman indeed, including old King Carol and his fiddlers three, Paganini Baldwin, Joachim Bloom, Sir Johnny One Note, and choirs of fiddlers, whole companies of fiddlers, nations of fiddlers, senatorial and parliamentarian, all of whom may now sound A's for a dead soldier and then go into a pavan. Call it None But the Purple Heart. Among the heavy drums, Hank sat and played the bazooka, played the sweet bazooka. Played it sweet and low, and he ducked his head from time to time as chords crashed all about him. And when the raid was over, he would rise and pick his pack up and go on against the kettle drums, against the snares and booby traps and paraphernalias of the well-rigged enemy. And by such tactics, his and others of his band storming the Appian Hill up as far as the third position, the comfort of a box seat at the Met was being made secure. And the undivided concentration of the music lover in his home was being convoyed safely through the program on the radio.
We'd been keeping company for 3 years before the war broke out, and I wanted to get married right after Pearl Harbor. But he enlisted immediately and said he'd rather wait until after the war because he didn't want me tied down to him in case he might get crippled or blinded or something and be a burden to me. We used to go to the movies once a week, depending on who was playing, or to a concert. Occasionally, we went dancing at the Palladium on a Saturday night. We were both crazy about photography and used to keep a picture album together in which we pasted pictures of all the places we'd been, all the people who were important to us, like our families, and the boy who first introduced us at a party. Hank became very serious toward the end, though, and he used to talk a great deal about the world and its problems. When Hank went away, I felt sure he'd come back. And I still can't get used to the idea that he won't.
While you were going to the movies once a week, the Weimar Republic failed you. While you were fumbling on a sofa, a paper hanger laid waste your plans. In your picture album, have you not left out the gallery of senators who voted down the League of Nations? And a group shot of the Chinese of Mukden, dead since 1931? And a close-up of the grease-proud face of Franco? These people were important to you also. Tonight, your arms lie empty of your lover because it was assumed in local legislative circles after one such war as this, the world was none of our concern. The empty pillow beside your own is stained with oil we sold the enemy. Our foreign policy was set against the occasional Saturday night at the Palladium. Or so it turned out when the scrap reserve got high enough in Yokohama.
I got a letter from him once, practically telling me how to run my newspaper. He demanded to know why we took the line we did in our editorials about certain fundamental and constitutional things. He accused us of being anti-war and against the United Nations, simply because we hammered away at waste in government and kept pointing out the dangers of trusting our allies too far. He was the type who indulged in the fruitless and misguided pastime of calling names and took occasion in his letter to label us fascists, simply because we took a strong position against the excesses of labor and warned the public not to encourage racial equality among population groups for whom equal rights would obviously create problems that would upset the entire social structure. It was typical of letters we received from numerous victims of propaganda. And so, naturally, we didn't print it.
Yes. Yes, he was the type to trust an ally in all seasons of travail. For in the summer of the year, when the star close by us shone upon the Midlands and the grasses grew exuberantly on the moors, Hank trusted the young men of an ally up as far as 30,000 feet against the finest squadrons of the obviously unvanquishable Luftwaffe. And in the spring of yet another year, when the dandelions in cool disdain of the communiques appeared among the corpses and spice-carrying breezes from neutral orchards to the south blew softly o'er the ammunition dumps, he trusted the young men of another ally as far as the border of Romania and still farther. He was also the type to enjoy the excesses of labor as they appeared in the shape of the gun in his hands, as they flew by the hundreds over his head, as they rolled on tracks and treads down the paths of most resistance. Hank was the type who insisted upon calling a spade a spade, his nose contending fascists by any other name smelled just as bad. He was an easy victim to the propaganda that all men were equally created, this being not especially a doctrine shortwave from abroad, but rather early American. And on the day he died, reconnaissance had told them that the foe lay straight ahead. But Pete knew very well some of the enemy was back at home, publishing daily and Sunday.
I killed him. It was early in the morning when we sailed the road. I did not see him, of course, because I was miles away. I merely pulled the drawstring which fired the 88-millimeter shell. As far as I'm concerned, it was merely a puff of smoke on the side of a hill. I have nothing against this man personally. I was merely doing my duty for my Führer and my fatherland, the struggle to save the world from the Bolshevik Democrats. It was entirely an impersonal matter. Heil Hitler!
Thank you.
When the last bomb has crumped and the tank is garaged, when the tape is scraped off the windows in London and the delicatessens of Copenhagen once again break out in green neon, and when the wives and children go down to the station in Council Bluffs knowing that victory comes in on the 5:45, Mrs. Peters will be sitting alone at the front room window, listening to the bells and the whistles. What will you be doing then, Litzboy? Where will you be going then, Warmaker Extraordinary? What impersonal matter will absorb you on that day, Master of Europe? The mother of the smoke puff on the hillside will finger a worn gold star, remembering the son you killed merely in the name of the Mystic of Munich.
I'm Charlie Faraday. Me and Hank were crawling on our bellies up the slope one morning. I was a stinking big red flash. When I looked around again, Hank was just a mess of rags and a couple of bones sticking through. Me and Hank used to get into arguments about the war. He used to talk about freedom. He said that's what we're fighting for. Well, for cranny's sakes, I knew that. He didn't have to tell me that. Anybody except a fascist louse would agree that's the best thing in the world anybody could fight for. But what I'd like to know is, why do you have to fight for it every 25 years? Can't somebody figure a way around that? What bothers me is whether I'm being a sucker. Because if this war don't add up to something big, something bigger than ever came out of any other war, then I don't know what I'm doing in this outfit. I used to say to Hank that if the people who are still alive when this one's over, if those people don't do something sensible about it, then what the heck's the use? What's the good of guys like Hank Peters getting knocked off if nobody knows what to do over their dead bodies?
I was Hank Peters. I assure you that I hated to go. It's not easy to leave a woman crying at a train gate. It's not easy to leave a mother standing at a window, or walk away and not look back. You can get lonesome no matter what when you're far from home, especially if you don't know when, if ever, you're coming back. I am dead of the mistakes of old men. I am very dead. But no deader than the British who struck at Alamein, and the Reds who crossed the Dnieper going west. I am silenced. No more silent than the partisans of Yugoslavia who fought tanks with their bare hands and a bottle of benzene. I am buried, but no deeper than the children of Chongqing. I know how there will be the jubilation at the end. How the proclamations will be sent out on the waiting air. They will gather in committee, pose for pictures, sign the papers. Territories will be wrangled and big punishments performed. It will be seen, too, that the ruins are most carefully policed. Oh, there'll be a stirring and a busyness about the capitals. And Charlie Faraday will wonder if perhaps he's being answered. The charters will be sealed in wax above the bodies of the dead. And all the words will make a noise of truth and sensibility. But let me tell you, from my acre of now undisputed ground, I will be listening.
I will be tuned to clauses in the contract where the word democracy appears. And how the freedoms are inflected to a Negro's ear. I shall listen for a phrase obliging little peoples of the earth, for partisans and Jews and Puerto Ricans, Chinese farmers, miners of tin ores beneath Bolivia. I shall listen how the words go easy into Russian and the idioms translated to the tongue of Spain. I shall wait and I shall wait in a long and long suspense for the password that the peace is setting solidly. On that day, will you please let my mother know why it had to happen to her boy?
You have been listening to a repeat performance of Untitled, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for CBS, starring the distinguished actor Frederick March.
Columbia presents Corwin on Tuned to Yesterday from May 30th, 1944 on CBS. And that wraps up this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for tuning in.